a most extraordinary thing has happened. In case not all of you are aware, seems that we've been given the gift of another day. Another day to know God and to love God and to serve God. I mean, perhaps as much as an entire day. Maybe we wouldn't know for sure. But how wonderful. Don't miss a moment of it today. How amazing. If your own ministry parallels what ministry that my brother Robert and I and our other brothers are called into, on a very regular occasion, we're invited to listen with people who are making life decisions, who are sifting and sorting, trying to make faithful, wise decisions about their life. What they should do, where they should go, to what they should say yes or no. And this may also be your own personal experience. Certainly is mine. I'd like to reflect with you now, some this morning as we gather, about how we know and look for and listen to God's guidance as we participate in what Jesus called the building of the kingdom here on earth, as we lean into God's future. If I were to describe to you in one sentence someone whom you do not know and simply told you, if I told you he's a real dreamer, I suspect you'd have a rather dubious impression of this person. Or if I would tell you a plan that someone has just dreamed up, that might sound like a scheme or something quite naive, but probably not a plan on which you'd put much stock. I think we are prone to put stock in what has empirical validity, what we can quantify or dissect or anchor or manage by objective in concrete reality. But my hunch is that probably for most of us, there is another level or a deeper way of knowing, a subconscious channel of meaning or leading that flows into our soul, to which we at least sometimes pay attention and should probably more. How God's revelation comes to us, or more importantly, how God's revelation has come to you and is coming to you now in this season of your life. The mystery of God's revelation. I'd like to give you a few snapshots from Matthew's Gospel, the first two chapters, which you will know well. We hear that Mary discovers she is pregnant. Not by Joseph, not by another man, but by the Holy Spirit, which would seem something of a stretch. We know that what Mary tells Joseph is simply to repeat what had been said to her. By whom? An angel. Let's say if a woman came to any of us here and told us a similar story about being, as we say, touched by an angel, it would probably give us pause. But Joseph, we hear, is a just and honorable man. And though the law gives him every reason to publicly denounce Mary's rather obvious and disgraceful, what else could it be? Fornication. If for no other reason than to save his own good name, he elects simply to, as we read, dismiss Mary quietly. Something quite beautiful here about his respecting her dignity, I think, even with this concocted story she is obviously telling. And then, here's my point, something happens. Joseph dreams. He is told in his dream not to be afraid, not to leave Mary, that this is a good and blessed thing of God that actually has happened to Mary, and that they indeed should be married. That revelation came in a dream, and Joseph staked his life, and Mary's life, and Jesus' life, on a dream. The next snapshot, early in Matthew's Gospel, concerns the wise men, these astrologers who live in the East. Something compels them to be looking for this long-predicted Messiah. And how do they end up finding this Christ child, this Messiah? A star. They follow a star. Do you follow stars? If someone asked you why you, say, bought a particular piece of real estate and you answered, star, I followed a star. You'd probably say, yikes. People would probably start stepping away from you. But back to the wise men. They follow a star to the Christ child, and they bring their gifts, as we know, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And on leaving, they are warned to return home by another way because King Herod is on the prowl. How are they warned? It's a dream. A dream which they believe and follow. A star, then a dream. In the third snapshot, once these wise men leave, now Joseph is given a similar warning about King Herod, who is searching for this child to destroy him. Joseph is told to flee to Egypt for safety. Go now. And Joseph takes Mary and Jesus, and they flee. How was Joseph warned? He's warned in a dream, which he believed. He believes the dream. The fourth snapshot. This threatening King Herod dies. Joseph learns about it and is told that it is now safe to return to the land of Egypt, which he does. How is he told? He's told in a dream, which he believes. He believes the dream. The fifth snapshot. Joseph and the family no sooner return home than Joseph learns that Herod's successor, Archelaus, is an equal threat. Joseph is once more warned, and he goes away with his family to the district of Galilee. How is he warned? He's warned in a dream, which he believes. Now, if I were to ask you, do you believe your dreams? This is what you would say. Here's my hunch. Many of you would say, well, I don't dream. Now, our friends, the neurologists, will actually tell us that we do dream, and a fair amount. And if that be so, you might say, well, maybe so, but I don't remember my dreams, which is a point taken. Nonetheless, I would surmise that for most all of us, there are, I'll call them subconscious ways of knowing, that we actually recognize and trust, ways of knowing that elude empirical explanation. There are ways of knowing that have informed how we have made significant decisions in life. I'm not saying that any one of us has never made a mistake in judgment, but I am saying that for most of us here, I'm guessing, there is a kind of discernible guidance that taps into the depths of our souls that is quite personal and quite trustworthy and quite a significant part of our life history, be it through dreams or visions or hunches or intuitions, coincidences, impressions that form a tapestry of knowing for us. It may be difficult to talk about, perhaps even embarrassing sometimes, but undeniable and very real. I shared a conversation with someone in recent days who was facing a very significant life decision. The stakes were quite high, they told me, and they didn't know how they were going to be able to make the decision. And how should they be praying about this? How would they know what to do? They asked me. Well, I said, I didn't know. I don't know. But I was aware that this person had lived enough years to have made major life decisions before. And because of what I already knew about their life, I knew that some of these decisions had been undeniably good decisions. And so I asked them, how did you know before? When they had made a decision about getting married, about pursuing a particular vocation, about living in a particular place, how had they decided what to do? What did they look for? Was there anything of these significant life experiences, was there anything that they had in common which would give them some kinds of, I call them tools of discernment for the future or for right now? Well, they'd never thought about it that way. I mean, tools of discernment, it wasn't quite that fancy. It wasn't even conscious completely how they had decided what they had decided. But there was something. There was something there they recognized. And they began to reflect aloud. And for the first time, they realized some ways that they had come to know and to trust God's leading in their life, now that they thought about it. This was not hard science. They said they were not ready to write a book. But they acknowledged there was a kind of deep knowing, and they knew the landscape and the signs, they recalled, which they found quite trustworthy. For this person, the points of God's guidance, what I'm calling here tools of discernment, were all in the categories of dreams and visions and hunches and intuitions and what could be called coincidences and impressions. If we were to tabulate the Bible, the amount of scriptural text given over to the report of dreams and visions and prophecies and angelic visitations and other, I'll call them indirect references to God's mysterious and yet undeniable leading of people, like with the wise men being guided by a star, we would find that these phenomena comprise approximately how much of the Bible? It's about 1/3 of the Bible. It's not insignificant. Dreams and visions and prophecies and angelic visitations and other indirect references to God's mysterious and yet undeniable guidance. Approximately 1/3 of the Bible. And yet I would say that this is quite countercultural for most of us who live in the Western world. I'd say, though, there's likely here a great gift for us to reappropriate in knowing God's revelation and God's guidance to us now. I think there's a gift here. There's several things come to mind about our reappropriating God's guidance in these ways. For some of us, I think there is a real grace in our reclaiming what we may have unlearned. I suspect for many of us, somewhere along the way of our formation into adulthood, we tacitly embraced a kind of apotheosis of reason. That what we can rationally quantify, compute, defend, explain, adjudicate, is always the way and always the best. I think it's largely the way we do business in the Western world. It's not how artists function. But I would say it is how probably many, perhaps most of us, have been trained to navigate in life in the modern Western world. Now, I'm not down on the use of reason or hard science. I mean, that would be silly. I'm simply saying that it's not enough. That life is deeper than that, which is something I think that we know innately as children. As children, we have other ways of knowing that we adults are prone to discount as imaginary worlds. And yet to children, this is very real. I would say that what we witness in children is this God-given capacity to know, to see, to hear, to dream, to realize, to imagine, to play, to understand in ways that for many of us adults defy rational explanation. But which reflect and inform the goings-on of the deep heart and give witness to our God-given capacity to know on many different levels. And I would say that for many of us in the Western world, we have probably unlearned some deeper ways of knowing and seeing and hearing and dreaming. I recall a story told by the eminent psychologist Carl Jung, who you may know centered much of his work on dreams. Jung spoke of a conversation he had had with the chief of the Pueblo Indians named Okwaya Biano. Jung asked the chief's opinion of white people, and he was told that it was not a very high one. White people, said Okwaya Biano, seem always upset, always looking for something, with the result that their faces are covered with worry. And he added that white people must be crazy because they think with their heads. And it is well known, so said the chief, that only crazy people do that. Jung asked in surprise how this great chief thought, to which Okwaya Biano replied that naturally, he thought with his heart. So that is one thing, a suggestion, to do some reflecting on how you have known in the past. Stretch back, if you can, to your childhood in ways which may be beyond rational explanation. What has helped you to get to this point in your life, given the navigations and decisions that you have had to make? Are they dreams or visions or hunches or intuitions or coincidences or impressions? What are the tools of discernment in the ground of your being on which you can intentionally draw? For some of you, it might be actually quite helpful to put a pad of paper beside your bed and to be more attentive in the night's sleep to your dreams, what is being mirrored to your soul. It might be very helpful. The second thing that comes to mind in terms of our being more attentive to God's revelation is to ground what you sense is God's revelation in some other point of revelation you know you can trust. If you have some new, what you think is a revelation, in the form of a dream, let's say, ask God for another confirming dream. If the revelation is in a line of poetry or a passage of the scriptures that emerges out of your memory, does this have integrity? Does it have integration? Is there a sense of continuity in this with who you are or where you are or what you are or where you thought you were headed? Or is this revelation, what you think is revelation, coming out of left field? If it's coming out of left field, perhaps best to wait. Just wait. Wait for a bridge to be built in your soul, maybe in the form of another word or thought or memory that creates a kind of continuity with where you've been and where you are and where you thought you were headed. For some of us, we've likely learned how important it is to share our own source of revelation with someone else whom we can trust. Self-deception is such a slippery slope. Not long ago, I was sharing my sense of revelation from God on some matter. I was sharing this with one of our brothers in the monastery, someone who knows me well, and he listened carefully. And then he said to me about my revelation. He said, "Well, Curtis, that's certainly convenient." And he went on to remind me why he couldn't imagine this being so. Quite. Rather humbling, very helpful. So I would say share your sense of revelation with someone who says their prayers, who knows you well, whom you can trust. There's a wonderful line in the book of Proverbs, "Iron sharpens iron, and so one person sharpens the wits of another." So I'm suggesting, remember backwards. How have you gotten to where you are? How have you come to know in your decision making? That's one. A second thing is to look for a confirmation of God's revelation. And then thirdly, take heart. If you find yourself praying for God's guidance, God is guiding you already. Do you know what we teach the faithful? Prayer is always a response to God. We're not initiating anything. We're always responding to God. Your desire for guidance is a seed of revelation, at least a seed. Maybe it's starting to bloom. It's at least a seed. God has already caught your attention. In those moments, I would say your prayer is not, "Where are you, God?" I don't think that's the prayer. God is already there in the question or in your sense of need. In that sense of real absence, God is really present. God is there already in the question, in the desire. God is with you in this. Maybe your prayer is rather, "What are you trying to show me, gracious God?" And you know how it is that you've come to know things in life, which is no mystery to God. God knows how you know. God knows your limitations. I think this is what the Incarnation is about. I mean, God is well apprised of how you know. God who, to quote from the Psalms, Psalm 139, "God who has created your inmost parts and from whom nothing is hidden." Remember how you have known. Look for a confirmation. Take heart in God's guidance, which is already in your desire for guidance. The guidance is already at work. And then fourthly, I would say, do what you want. Do what you want most deeply. God, who knows you and loves you, created you with a will. You are not a robot. You are not a clone. When it comes to the gift of God's guidance, it's not a package deal. It's a personal gift that comes out of your own history. Get in touch with your deepest desires. Look for them to be confirmed. And then do what you want to God's glory. I oftentimes pray when I'm moving with confidence. Do you remember the etymology of confidence? Confide, with faith. When I'm moving with confidence, in a particular direction, to simply put a little asterisk on my prayer, to simply say, and gracious God, if I'm headed in the wrong direction, just close the door, turn off the light, put up a gate, do something that will catch my attention, something that I would recognize. Otherwise, I move freely and desirously and confidently in this direction. And I pray to God's glory. Do it. Do it freely. To use an angelic metaphor, I might call this winging it in God's presence. And if you were to ask me, will you always get it right? Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask that question because I haven't, and I don't. But I do desire it, as would you, to desire to be attentive and faithful to the myriad ways of God Emmanuel, God with us, directing us, impressing us, guiding us, alluring us, loving us into that place we see as our eternal home. Some of you may know a wonderful prayer from Thomas Merton, where Merton prays, "My God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have that desire in all that I'm doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do, in this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." What is God revealing to you now in this season of your life? What's your sense as you anticipate the future, as you anticipate your place and your plans and your participation in God's future. What is it? What is it? I'm going to suggest we just pause for a few moments for reflection. You can do this. You can do this. And thank you for your leadership to us in the church for helping us do this too. Thank you for your ministry to us. You find at the two doorways on the table a poem which some of you may find meaningful, a poem from Mary Oliver, which is Smacking of Life, and it's entitled When Death Comes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Curtis.